I've spent a lot of time thinking about whether I should speak on this topic, because I said at the beginning I don't want to cause people offence, and it seems to me that if you ever criticise anything to do with Anzac Day, you cause more offence, certainly more than if you criticise Christmas or Easter or God or Jesus or anything. But I do want to put something out there that people might consider is worth further thought, so I chose to offer it today, partly because I thought it does carry on from some of the thoughts we've talked about, the effects of patriarchy, and because the world is in such a mess at the moment, as we seem to slide more and more into militarism and suffer the impacts of war and warlike behaviour. I'd like to start with three caveats. Firstly, I'm a pacifist. Secondly, I have a military heritage. And thirdly, whatever criticisms I make of the commemoration of Anzac Day are not meant to denigrate the bravery of those who fought for Australia in past wars, nor to suggest that we shouldn't acknowledge the appalling sacrifice of Australian lives in World War I and in all the wars that this nation has taken part in. Well, why am I a pacifist? I'm a pacifist because, quite simply, I can't see how anyone can interpret Jesus' teachings as anything other than a call to renounce warfare and aggression. Jesus said, love your enemies, do good to those who persecute you. Now, it's a hard teaching, and of course it's easier for those to embrace who've never lived through a war in their own country, as I have not. But if as much effort had been directed towards working out peaceful solutions as regarding war as inevitable and a problem solver, I actually believe that every war in the 20th century could have been averted. I can talk about that later if anybody wishes, but this is particularly true of the Second World War, which many people say, well, if Australia was ever justified in entering any war, it was that one, and I'd agree with that. But if there hadn't been such a thirst for vengeance of the nations who actually came out victorious in World War I, then Hitler would never have risen to power and Germany would probably never have gone to war again. As to my military heritage, my father's family were career soldiers for several generations, and I hope I don't judge them for making those choices. It was a very different world that they lived in. But I do strongly believe that as Christians now, we should all do what we can to promote a peaceful society and not unquestionably accept the cultural practices that foster militarism. And perhaps I feel also a bit like people who say, if you have an Irish heritage, you're the only person who should ever tell Irish jokes. That from the kind of background that I come from, I can say what I like about the military and with impunity. So what's wrong with Anzac Day? Or to put it more clearly, what's wrong with the way Anzac Day is observed, commemorated, celebrated, however you want to say it? Anzac Day dates from the 25th of April 1915, when a combined Allied force, which we sometimes forget, there were British, Indian, Australian and New Zealand troops who converged on the rocky shores of the Hellespont to capture the strait. And why? To enable the Russian Black Sea fleet to pass freely into the Mediterranean. Gallipoli, or Çanakkale, as the Turks call it, was part of the Ottoman or Turkish Empire, which in 1915 entered the war on the side of the German-Austrian alliance. The military action was masterminded by Winston Churchill. It was a disaster from start to finish. Of the Anzac force, approximately 8,000 Australians and 2,000 New Zealanders were killed, and many others were wounded. High casualties partly stemmed from inadequately trained troops who were landed on an unprotected beach where they were expected to wait under fire until ordered to proceed. Many opted to scramble up the cliffs instead of facing what they thought was certain death on the beach under withering fire, and they got killed anyway, but they earned a name for bravery. Seems to be the thing that we think is most important. The first Anzac Day commemoration was held a year later among Australian and possibly New Zealand forces in France and in London and in parts of Australia. Early commemorations consisted of morning church services and meetings later in the day when a minute's silence for the fallen was observed. Apparently, at the first Anzac Day, they tried to observe 3 minutes' silence, and people were fainting because you can't stand silent for 3 minutes without your head going fuzzy. After the war, the Returned Services Leader, as we know as the RSL, became strongly involved, insisting that people, and especially school children, should be educated about the, quote, imperishable tradition of the landing. Anzac Day, as it's now commemorated, is based on myths and half-truths. Firstly, it has been claimed that as Australia's national day. Many times I've seen it written and heard that said that this was the day that Australia became a nation. This dates from an outdated concept that nations are founded in warfare. Until the men of a particular place have spilt their blood in attacking others, their bit of territory can't be called a nation. Apart from being totally outdated, like many concepts from the Victorian Age of Empire, which we have abandoned long ago, such as their racist and sexist attitudes, it's not even true. While the idea of Australia has existed since before the beginning of the 19th century, and let's remember that Matthew Flinders titled his account of his circumnavigation of the continent A Voyage to Australia, the modern nation was pronounced on New Year's Day 1901 in Centennial Park, Sydney, and afterwards in the other capitals. That's our national day. That's the day that should be Australia Day, and I don't care if it's New Year's Day. If we like, we can have an extra holiday after it to make up, but not the 26th of January, where they only landed in New South Wales, and certainly not 25th of April overseas. Secondly, Australian blood had been spilled in several wars by the time of the Anzac landings, even if you discount the colonial regiments that served in the Sudan, China and South Africa. At least one Australian contingent went to the South African or Boer War. More importantly, it wasn't even the first World War I battle for Australian service personnel. A combined military and naval expeditionary force went to northeast New Guinea in 1914, captured the German garrison there, and some of them killed doing it. So they were the first Australian service personnel to spill their blood for this country in World War I, not the Anzacs, and yet actually I didn't even know that that force existed until a few years ago, and I suspect some of you have never heard of it either. Why? Why have they been largely ignored and this big deal has been made about Anzac Day? You know, that's one question you could ask. It's just not part of the World War I narrative somehow. Maybe it was because very few were killed in New Guinea. Well, if numbers counted the most, of the 60,000 Australians' lives lost in World War I, a sixth of those who served overseas were on the Western Front. Gallipoli pales in comparison with the deaths on the Western Front. 28,000 casualties in 6 weeks, in the first 6 weeks of the AIF were in battle in World War I. So why isn't that more important than the idea of the Anzac landing? That's a historian's argument. If you're going to commemorate something for those kind of reasons. Secondly, what did the original ceremony commemorate? Well, the invasion of a foreign territory by Australian and other Allied troops. Whatever else our soldiers were doing, they were not protecting Australia. They were sent to prove that Australia was worthy part of the British Empire, prepared to fight for the British Empire. They were commanded by a British general until the last year of the war, and it's even debatable whether they fought under an Australian flag. Some images show a Union Jack, some a red ensign. Now, this may seem like splitting hairs to someone who's not embroiled in the arguments about the importance of Anzac Day and all these, but all these assertions, including arguments about why we should not change the Australian flag, it's sacred because the Anzacs fought under it, have been used to cement in the public mind that Anzacs and Anzac Day are inviolable and you can't change anything because somehow or other it was involved with Anzac Day and the Anzacs. Another troubling feature is the common use of the word sacred. Dictionary definitions of sacred are as an adjective, connected with God or a God, or dedicated to a religious purpose and so deserving veneration, such as sacred rites. It's also ascribed to music and texts, such as the Bible. How did people involved in a military action become sacred? Or how did the action itself become sacred? Especially to a nation that often regards itself as secular. How often have I read, you know, religion isn't important to Australians, even though we were one of the most sectarian societies at the time of World War I. By the 1930s, the format was much as it is today, a dawn service, a 10 a.m. march, and then a free afternoon, usually dedicated to boozy reunions and in the latter time to football matches. Since World War II, Anzac Day has morphed into a commemoration of all Australian service personnel who fought in offshore wars, with gradual grudging acceptance of nurses, militia troops who didn't leave Australia, and others who were regarded as not real soldiers. I remember my father talking about chocos. Chocos were chocolate soldiers, otherwise known as the militia rather than the AIF. Although the march's ranks were swelled by subsequent operations in Korea and Malaysia, Vietnam veterans were less likely to take part, feeling themselves abandoned by the RSL. Thus, the Anzac tradition is an elitist, exclusive, white, masculine one. By mid-century, it was commonly believed that Anzac Day would die out. This belief was reflected in various media. Alan Seymour's 1958 play, The One Day of the Year, about the difference of opinion between an ex-serviceman and his son over Anzac Day, was regarded as controversial because it depicted the younger generation as uncaring about the Anzac tradition. During and after the Vietnam War, some protesters targeted Anzac Day marches, accusing the organisers of fostering militarism and ignoring rape and racism. Well, of course, rape has been a behaviour of invading armies as long as there have been armies. But to suggest that Australians indulged in this behaviour was apparently unacceptable, even sacrilegious. The Australian War Memorial, where I worked for 2 years as a research officer, in a rare period of enlightenment, once put together an exhibition titled Too Dark for the Light Horse. Indigenous men were not welcome in the AIF. Only those who managed to disguise their Aboriginality were able to enlist, and you have to wonder why on earth they wanted to, after all they hadn't got from this country. Many excellent horsemen were turned away from joining the Light Horse, hence the name of the exhibition. While the dead are commemorated, the permanently injured are often ignored, and I'm sure some of you will remember Eric Bogle's 1980 song and the band played Waltzing Matilda, which is about a soldier who was crippled in the Great War, of which the penultimate verses run. And so now every April I sit on my porch and I watch the parades pass before me, and I see my old comrades, how proudly they march, reviving old dreams of past glories. And the old men march slowly, old bones stiff and sore. They're tired old heroes from a forgotten war. It's a difficult line, that one. And the young people ask, what are they marching for? And I ask myself the same question. But the band plays Waltzing Matilda and the old men still answer the call. But as year follows year, more old men disappear. Someday, no one will march at all. And then suddenly something changed. Young people began making pilgrimages to Gallipoli, in the words of historian Marilyn Lake, backpackers wrapped in flags, playing rock music, drinking beer, and proclaiming their national identity on the distant shores of Turkey. And I'm sure the irony isn't lost to you. And leaving piles of rubbish behind them too. Bob Hawke, then Prime Minister, did the trip in 1990, and his successor, Paul Keating, kissed the ground of Kokoda later in the decade and said, this is the real place we should be celebrating, not Anzac. But anyway, that's another story. The declining attendances at Anzac Day functions suddenly reversed, and attendances at services began to rise. All of this reached a peak at the centenary commemoration in 2015. In the decade prior to the centenary, historians began voicing concern about the militarisation of Australian society, especially as it was being taught in schools. In 2010, two distinguished historians, Marilyn Lake and Henry Reynolds, edited a collection of essays titled What's Wrong with Anzac? And yes, I did borrow their title for this lecture. These essays expressed concern about the ways that Anzac history was being taught, but also public reactions to lectures, talks and opinion pieces that were even slightly critical. Marilyn Lake opened the introduction to the book with this statement. To write about what's wrong with Anzac today is to court the charge of treason. You may think that's an exaggeration. Lake recounted her experience of giving a public lecture, followed by an article in the Age newspaper on, quote, the myth of Anzac. It was not her original audience, the History Teachers Association of Victoria, who levelled the accusation of treason, but a member of the public who read the newspaper article. Comments included, what had academic, clever dick historians, especially female ones, ever done for their country? This fool of a woman should be charged with treason. How disgusting to call Anzac a myth, and so on. What had she done? Simply what I'm doing here, pointing out that the concept of Australia's nationhood being born at Gallipoli was outdated, imperialist, masculinist, and militaristic. It was time in the 21st century, she argued, to move on from that and embrace more relevant and inclusive values suited to a free and independent republic. Probably some of them got upset about that word as well. Indeed, some responses praised her for having the courage to speak out. But why should a social commentator need courage to voice a well-researched and reasoned opinion? And why should she have to put up with abuse for doing so? If she'd said, let's get rid of Christmas, how many people would have abused her? Or Easter? Let's take Christ out of Christmas. People have been saying it for years, haven't they? In another chapter, Henry Reynolds, and I'm sure some of you are familiar with his work, his searing critiques of Australia's treatment of Indigenous people, such as The Other Side of the Frontier, related his experience of speaking to high school students about Anzac Day. He asked the students why they thought Anzac Day was important and found their responses dominated by two ideas. The Anzac landing had made Australia a nation, and the young diggers had shown a spirit that was inimitably Australian. Reynolds commented, these answers didn't surprise me. It was indeed hard to imagine how a class like this one anywhere in contemporary Australia would have come up with other ideas or other answers. So pervasive was the common view and so constantly repeated in speeches, articles, lectures and lessons. And I must say I can add my own experience to this because when I started teaching at Murdoch University in the 1980s and I used to have a tutorial on war and I had similar responses from the students. I was actually horrified how conservative they all were because when I went to university in the 70s, students were quite different and it all changed in that decade or so. And they were about how important it was to celebrate Anzac Day. And yes, it was really quite a generational shift. Most disturbing. Yes, so pervasive was a common view, constantly repeated in speeches, articles, lectures and lessons. Leaders in all walks of life affirmed this interpretation of Anzac Landing. Even though they disagreed about many other things, the interpretation had been sanctified by reiteration. This view is now so powerful and so pervasive that it is rarely questioned. To do so is to show inexcusable disrespect for the dead. So criticism of Anzac Day is always linked to disrespecting the dead or disrespecting our soldiers or our armed forces. This is a sad and troubling critique on history teaching in high schools. John Howard reinforced the idea that there was only one history narrative, the one he agreed with. All other interpretations were wrong. History is a discipline built on argument, inquiry, and learning to develop and test theories. Students are supposed to be taught to think for themselves, not to learn as if by rote one limited perspective. Now, that's a feature that the West has fancied happened in communist regimes and criticised them roundly for it. You say something about the futility of war, for example, as I have done on LinkedIn, and I got told that I was the kind of person who shouldn't be teaching in a university. So I roundly turned on the person who'd said this and said, and you're the kind of person who thinks students should only be taught one point of view. And he didn't get back after that. So where are we now and what is being commemorated? An item in The Guardian from 2021 indicated that since 2015, Anzac Day attendances had declined quite rapidly. Well, hooray for that. Though no doubt the pandemic had something to do with that. One would hardly think it from the days of saturation media coverage before and during the event each year. And the only thing I can think of that is similarly saturated is the Mardi Gras. So those two things every year, we get days of advertisements beforehand, everybody assuming that we're going to want to watch them. Perhaps the attitude that everyone accepts the commemoration of Anzac Day as right and proper was nowhere more recently illustrated than in 2020 when lockdowns forced the abandonment of the usual dawn services and marches. It was assumed that people would want to observe the day by getting up at dawn and playing the last post in their driveways, irrespective of whether their neighbours appreciated it. I didn't appreciate it when my neighbours did it. In an age when we're becoming circumspect about forcing our ideas on others, I suspect most of us who work have received at some point somewhat patronising messages about not sending inappropriate greetings at Christmas and Easter. Not so with talk about commemorating Anzac Day. Even now that we recognise that our enemy, the Turks, fought bravely at Gallipoli too, and yes, there were other Allied soldiers there besides Australians, and yes, Australia does consist of people who are our former enemies as well as our allies, and they're all Australians. Even accepting the more expanded, belated recognition of women, Indigenous and other non-Anglo contributors to Australia's war effort over the past 125 years. And, of course, I'm talking right back to the beginning of the century, not just Anzac. The format is still one of glorifying soldiers in uniforms and military hardware, with the ear-splitting flypasts at an integral part of the ceremony. It remains a largely masculinist, white, exclusive ceremony with roots in the militaristic, imperialist tradition that valorises the act of attacking and seizing territory belonging to other races. So, where to from here? Is there an appropriate response for a Christian? I'm reasonably confident that the early Christians, pre-Constantine, would have had no part in such a ceremony because they eschewed warfare and militarism. Whereas we have turned our churches into war memorials and our war memorials into sacred places. The mainstream churches have blessed war and warlike actions and often spoke against those brave enough to refuse to take up arms. And I have a little time, so I'll digress here. I published a book a couple of years ago called Hell No, We Won't Go, which was about people who resisted being recruited for the Vietnam War mainly and from national service from the 1950s onwards. One of the people who contacted me told me a story about how he had joined the military and during his training he was so appalled by it that he decided he couldn't continue and he applied to be a conscientious objector. The army did send him back to Perth to prepare for his court case, which they all had to do if they were going to apply to be conscientious objectors, to be recognised as conscientious objectors. He was a member of a Baptist church and none of the leaders of his church would speak on his behalf because they disagreed with his action. One Baptist minister, Glenn Brooks, who wasn't a minister in his church, spoke up for him. And that says something about the church's attitude to militarism and its lack of sympathy for people who hold alternative positions. I mean, this is the early 70s. Yes, I think it was 1970-71 when this happened to him. Well, should we commemorate our war dead? I believe that we should, but in the context of celebrating the end of war, such as Remembrance Day, not in the opening of a conflict, which is really what Anzac Day commemorates. Anzac Day, and especially the dawn service, is unique to Australia and New Zealand, and in that sense it has a certain value that is not anybody else's ceremony but ours. But what has it become? Every dawn service, the story of Gallipoli landings is trotted out, so while later ceremonies might be a recognition of all service personnel, it's clear that the invasion of the Gallipoli Peninsula on the 25th of April 1915 is what's being remembered at that first service. The Australian War Memorial, once a monument to Australia's war dead, is now a showcase for military hardware, bought and housed with a $5 million gift from the government. Its aim is, quote, to better recognise the contemporary service of our country's veterans now and into the future. Yet with all this recognition, there remains so little help for those permanently scarred by their war service. And this point was made by many who campaigned against the expansion of the war memorial, believing that the funds could be employed more usefully and in a more humanitarian way to benefit veterans, not valorising the machines of death. How then should we commemorate our dead? It's worth reflecting that the powerful anti-war movements of the 1920s were inspired by the belief that if there was another war like that of 1914-18, it would negate the sacrifice of those who died. It would make their deaths in vain. People worked for peace, A worldwide petition urging peaceful negotiations as a means of settling disputes between nations collected 18,000 Australian signatures. People had faith in the League of Nations. We laugh now and sneer and say, oh, League of Nations, you know, they didn't even have a military arm, so why did people believe in them? They believed that a worldwide authority that could actually negotiate with different nations had a chance of bringing about a more peaceful world. There was debate about commemoration. Should war memorials be stone monuments or something more useful, like hospitals or other public facilities? Not everyone wanted stone monuments. Not even the Australian War Memorial was unanimously accepted as an appropriate monument to the war dead. What form of commemoration would I like to see? Well, not masked uniforms and overhead flypasts exhibiting military strength. Not speeches that emphasise bravery and ignore the futility and the moral bankruptcy of warfare or its real and terrible cost. Now, on April 28th, just 3 days after the hoopla of Anzac Day each year, small crowds gather in various places to remember those who died at work or by work-related causes. They get virtually no media coverage. Yes, there is a union presence with banners, and there's plenty of fluoro jackets and big boots, but most people pass by without a second look, and I've been there at Solidarity Park behind Parliament House many a time, and people just walk past, not even curious. The ceremony is solemn, low-key, and occupies about an hour. A priest officiates. There's a speaker from one of the unions, not praising the bravery of those who go to work in dangerous spaces, but categorically stated that work deaths are avoidable and unacceptable. Wreaths are laid to remember the dead, including the victims of Wittenoom Blue Asbestos, who are still dying, and in a few years, preventable deaths from asbestos and silica-related diseases in Australia threaten to eclipse the dead of all our world wars. And in the case of silica, it's not people falling ill years after they worked on it. It's happening right now with people younger than most of us in their 20s and 30s. And yet it seems that Anzac Day, and to a lesser extent Remembrance Day, will continue to attract the media spotlight. Anzac Day in particular is likely to remain a sacred cow, immune to criticism and certainly immune to change. Every year the same tired old platitude, they shall not grow old as we who are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn at the going down of the sun, and in the morning we shall remember them. Lawrence Binyon, British poet. If we're going to have poetry on Anzac Day, let's have something gritty and realistic, something that conveys the agonies of those who served and returned. There was plenty of it written after World War I, and I'll finish with an example from the poet Vance Palmer. It's called A Farmer Remembers the Somme. Will they never pass, fade or pass, the mud and the misty figures endlessly coming, in file through the foul morass, and the grey flood water ripping the reeds and grass, and the grey steel wings drumming. The hills are bright in the sun. There's nothing changed or marred in the well-known places. The work for the day is done. There's talk and quiet laughter and gleams of fun on the old folks' faces. I have returned to these, the farm and the kindly bush, and the young calves lowing, but all that my mind sees is a quaking bog in a mist, stark mapped trees and the dark somme flowing. Right? Questions, comments?
A little known fact, 41,000 allies were involved or died in the Gallipoli, but 86,000 Turks died.
Mm.
And people don't ever get that side of the story. And I, you know, I'm not passing a judgment, but remember them.
I don't disagree with most of what you're saying about the glorification of Anzac Day, but I've been to a few dawn services. There's no flight past at that time of the morning, but I found them very solemn and very much focused on remembering the war dead and nothing else. So that's just my experience with the actual dawn services. But all the other issues you raised, I think they're worth
well, not so much a dawn service, though. I don't know if you've ever been to the one at King's Park, because when I still teach, I used to teach a unit called Australians at War, and a lecturer used to come and talk about Anzac Day, and he said up in King's Park, even at dawn service, there were so many hundreds of people there and there was so much noise and It was just, there was no atmosphere there at all. And he said, then you can walk down St. George's Terrace and get a gunfire breakfast. Yeah, well, I think the little ones probably maintain something of the old dawn services, but the big ones, and certainly the one at the War Memorial in Canberra, there's hundreds, if not thousands of people go to that. So,
thank you, Bobby. Yes, I came to the same conclusion about Anzac Day, the invasion of Gallipoli, etc., when I studied history at high school over 50 years ago now, and I've held that opinion since. And it was reinforced when we went to visit Gallipoli in about 2001. And one of the things that really struck me when we visited Gallipoli was the lack of that militarism, that victorious, we beat them sort of attitude on the part of the Turks in the museum and the war memorial there. But I want to ask you a question. I have heard that the Ottoman Empire originally wanted to enter the war on the side of the British, and the British said no, and that forced them to enter on the side of the Germans. Do you know if that's true?
No, I don't.
It is true.
Is it you saying it's not true?
I don't know. I don't know that it's true. I do not know. I have never heard that.
Thank you, Bobby. As thorough and well researched as we would expect from you, thank you so much. And I am in agreement with so much of what you said. For me too, the broader question, because I link this also with the rise of nationalism around Australia Day and the role that governments and politicians have in cultivating nationalistic fervour, which then is broadened out. They want to be able to recruit an army for future, you know, the defence of the realm. This is, you know, we're often told this is the number one priority of government, is to protect our borders or whatever it is, you know, and so on. So I think what you're saying fits into this broader context of the agenda around how politicians and people of influence want to mobilise nationalism and the things around which they want a community of people to gather around. And I think that fundamental question of what we allow ourselves to gather around and consider ourselves Australian is one that's worth exploring even further.
Did you want to comment on that?
Oh, no, I agree. I remember when Australia Day was celebrated at the nearest convenient weekend, just so we could have a long weekend. You know, all this stuff about fireworks and cars driving around with flags and all that. I suppose one of the things that bothers me the most about this stuff is, I know that there are people comment online who believe that Gallipoli was a victory for the Allies, and they're so ignorant. I don't know whether they assume we wouldn't celebrate it or commemorate it if it wasn't a victory, but I've certainly seen that written, that the belief that the Allies actually won the Gallipoli campaign, which they clearly didn't. But just that intolerance for anybody else's point of view is most disturbing.
Bobby, I was just interested in, as you told the history of the narrative around Anzac Day, you mentioned Bob Hawke and Keating.
Mm.
My anecdotal perception, I'm interested in accuracy, historical, is it felt to me like the real expansion of mythology of Anzac Day was invested by John Howard.
It was actually.
That's my feeling. When I began to get uncomfortable with it, was that promotion of the nationalism, et cetera, and I locate that with John Howard, not according to Anzac.
But governments of both colours have given vast amounts to the war memorial in build, and what they're doing is actually building this great big hall full of tanks and stuff. And as I said, their aim now seems to be drawing attention to, aren't the military good today? It's not to do with the commemoration, because, I mean, the thing about the War Memorial is it's not just a museum. It was never intended to be just a museum. It was always intended to be a place where you commemorated the dead as well as a place where you informed people about the dead. But now it seems to be far more about informing people about what's going on in the world today than about what happened in the past. And there seems to me to be no cautionary message in it at all about, you know, this is what happens to people in war, that we don't show that ugly side of war, like people are killing their prisoners and rape and so forth. It happened on both sides of the conflict. You can't just blame the Japanese or somebody for all of that stuff.
There's a few, several thoughts that came out of that. I really appreciate your presentation, Bobby. The first was that since my kids have been in primary school, every Anzac Day, and quite often Anzac Day happened in the holidays, so there'd be a commemoration day at the primary school, often for a week of preparations, talking about Anzac myths and all this sort of thing and the soldiers and colouring in and stuff. And it was often like an assembly. And, yeah, Simpson and the Donkey, yeah. But Claire and I intentionally kept our kids home on those days and we wouldn't send them to school so that they would participate in that. And that felt like that was one of the few things we could do to push back. I remember Claire getting up during the lockdowns on Anzac Day and standing in the driveway, not to commemorate the war, but to stand as a witness to say never again.
Mm.
There was a few things that she got very angry about, but war and violence is one of them.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't know. The other thing that struck me was I was trying through the service to kind of hold together the where's God in this? And it felt to me like just in communion, the first thing that Jesus and the disciples do once they've had the Last Supper and communion is they go out and Peter is striking the ear of the priest's servant. And I recognise that's my... There's a part of me that wants to do that to Putin, And there's Jesus saying, no, we love this person.
Mm.
And that's a real confronting thing for me because I want, God to rain down legions of angels on Putin, And it's like there's this distinct thing saying, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
So I struggle with this. I fully recognise that. And I sit with the position that war and violence is the failure of dialogue and of peacemaking.
Yeah.
That it's an absolute travesty of our societies that ever happens that gets to that. So
yeah. I think the important thing about the historical aspect of it is that you remember that people weren't always like this. People seem to assume that just after the war everybody was all sort of, hooray Henry and carrying the flag. There were some people like that, but an awful lot of people just wanted absolutely nothing more to do with it. They wanted peace and they wanted peace to endure, and they didn't think necessarily that building piles of stone was a great way to remember the soldiers. So all of these things that are now sacred cows, I mean, if you, for instance, said, let's get rid of the war memorial in King's Park, they'd be absolutely pilloried. But a lot of people didn't want it. A lot of people didn't want the Fremantle one. They certainly didn't want the war memorial in Canberra. So, it's worth bearing in mind that people didn't always have this militaristic attitude about how they would commemorate their war dead.
Well, my grandfather was a chaplain in the First World War, and after he came back, he had war injuries, and the doctor said he couldn't go anywhere cold and damp. But he was a Methodist minister at Leaderville, and he was sent to Katanning, which was cold and damp, and passed away at 1945. So we lost our grandfather 10 years before I was born.
My uncle was gassed in the trenches in the British Army, my father's oldest brother, and he spent the rest of his life as a semi-invalid. So, I didn't have any immediate war dead, but he certainly died early as a result of that.
Maybe slightly off the point, but it's something which I think we really always need to remember is this is all about the commemoration of soldiers. But it's not soldiers who decide to go to war.
Mm.
It's always politicians who are not actually the most trusted members of our society, so the surveys tell us. But it's politicians who, for various reasons, say the soldiers are going to go to war. And I'm not sure where I'm going with that, but I think there's something important there that we need to recognise that. And if we are actually going to do something concrete to stop war, that's a very important point.
Well, it's not always politicians, because if the American military had had their way in the Cuba crisis, they'd have dropped a big one on Cuba. And it was Kennedy who actually resisted that. So I think the military top brass are often very keen to go to war as well.
I really appreciated hearing all those facts because you don't get told facts gratuitously much. It just makes me wonder about our clumsy groping for identity as a nation. It makes me think of the end of the very wonderful and sad Navalny film where he says evil flourishes when good people do nothing. It just makes me think about a vacuum. The Anzac Day services, I've been to the King's Park one and I've been amazed at the silence of a very big crowd, and this is a while ago when I could still, a brief period I could get up. And it felt to me like it was about collective grief for the dead and that was the only vehicle available, because as churches and church services and any, you know, moments that a society can share where it experiences these things and express reverence are few and far between. And in the same way that I know it was a very interesting phenomenon when Princess Diana died in that car crash and something else was happening. It wasn't just about her. There was some sort of collective grief that formed around that moment in Britain and elsewhere. So, yeah, I just wonder whether there's... And I also, sorry, this is a bit fragmentary. I've got a colleague at work who is very grumpy and she's a bit susceptible to Sky News and things, but she's very unhappy that Australia Day had a lower profile this year, and but there's around our office there's Chinese New Year flags. But again, I think I don't think she's a nationalist. I think she's looking for some sort of external expression of identity and some sort of collective thing that's missing.
One was just the whole positioning of the War Memorial in Canberra, that it sits opposite Parliament, and when I went to visit it, it symbolically looks like it's a challenge. So I just found its position and its size in Canberra really disturbing, let alone the content. And the other comment I had was about the Vietnam veterans, because I've seen many over the years that I have spent working, and very few. When I first started working at what was then the Vietnam Veterans Counselling Service, had ever attended an ANZAC service.
Mm.
If they did attend an ANZAC service, it was usually after they had started to process their traumas, and it was to remember those that they had served with.
Mm.
But prior to that, for them, they wanted nothing to do with ANZAC Day, and it wasn't because of how they had been treated. They just did not want to do anything that promoted war, and they experienced it as promoting war.
Yeah, yeah.
Then when they did start to go, they went to the smaller ones in the morning, and that was kind of about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My father used to belong to the RSL, and he had a badge with 1952 on it because that was the year he left the RSL, because he said that they didn't care about soldiers' interests, and they used to spend more time in entertaining bigwigs when they came to town than they cared about anything for the soldiers, so he left. And there's a lot of opinion like that about the RSL. You're the last one, I think.
I remember the only time I've ever visited the National War Memorial, and I was struck by a couple of things. One was that it was very different from all the other war memorials I'd seen around in other cities in terms of how the soldiers were represented. And the war memorial, they are represented as demigods. There is this, you know, that Art Deco sort of style to the thing which elevates them beyond the human. It's very different to, for instance, that one in, is it Hyde Park in Sydney? Where the soldiers just look tired.
Huge, yeah.
And, yeah, so what I was looking at in Canberra was a religion. And it was the first time I realised that Australia actually does have a national religion,
mm-hmm.
and it's not Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I get what Rose was saying about the need to find the sacred when we've declared ourselves to be a secularist nation, more or less exclusively secularist, and then need to find something else instead. And I guess that's what's disturbed me on a couple of times I've been to a Dawn service, is the feeling that our faith has been co-opted by the national religion in order to provide a vocabulary for expressing the sacred by this other faith that's not ours. And I worry that then our words take on a new meaning in the minds of people who think that that's what it means.
Yeah.
And words can do that very easily. What martyr means to a Christian is very different to what martyr means to a Muslim. And I think some of the concepts about Anzac Day Dawn services that equate soldiers invading Turkey with Jesus' death on the cross, I find that very troubling.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I could tell you many things about the War Memorial, but because I worked there for 2 years, but just two things briefly because we're running out of time. One is in the Hall of Memory, with stained glass windows, it's just like going into a church. The Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, which is there now, I mean, he was discovered in 1993 and brought back, is surrounded by a little coping and woe betide anyone that steps on it. Yeah, so that's very, very churchy. And just there were actually some boys that were evicted from the War Memorial because they were caught standing on the balcony and throwing coins down into the pool of reflection. That was deemed inappropriate behaviour, and they were actually sent out, and their mother was furious. But anyway, so there's definitely that strong feeling that soldiers are sacred, and they are, you know, they are just as like the early Christians who went to the stake or, you know, crucified or whatever it is, that it's a sacred thing, and you must not say anything against it. And that is very much magnified in the War Memorial. And I mean, I saw it time and again when I worked there. So yeah, I agree with you totally. Well, thanks everybody for your comments. It was good discussion, and we'll close with song number 50, Matthew 10, Behold, I Send You Out.